Chapter 10, Rocking the Cradle. Let us all work together to grasp the future to the best of our abilities, our energies, and our enthusiasms. 15 years hence, hopefully, we will have realized the marvelous opportunities we now face together. Alex Campbell, on the signing of the Prince Edward Island Comprehensive Development Plan, March 7th, 1969.
We are surprisingly well off in this province, considering our very limited ability to impose our will on those beyond our shores. T. Earl Hickey, presenting the 1974-75 PEI budget, April 2nd, 1974.
Alex Campbell's premiership can be understood in three phases. For the first 30 months, Campbell governed with a razor-thin majority and a bare-bones treasury. The middle period was a time of historic restructuring and modernization, boosted by unprecedented public resources and propelled by a demographic, economic, and public policy surge. After the 1974 election, and notably with the 1975 budget, the emphasis turned to tailoring expectations. These phases were not all-or-nothing propositions. The first 3 years produced one of the most impressive legislative records in PEI history, while the government balanced on a political and fiscal tightrope. The final 3 to 4 years benefited from the experience and refined vision gained through the first 2 mandates, at the same time as Campbell's government grappled with inflation, austerity, national economic slowdown, and the accumulation of issues that come with a third term in power. With the signing of the Comprehensive Development Plan in March 1969, things changed for Campbell and his government, and for Prince Edward Islanders. In a February television address, Premier Campbell spoke with Islanders about the difference that the development plan would make, telling them, "This may be our last chance to provide a future for this province." He went on to say that PEI's economic and financial condition was precarious, and that stopgap remedies and short-term policies will no longer serve the purpose. For Campbell, the central challenge was to close the gap between the two Canadas, a rich one and a poor one. As he told Islanders, "With each passing year, our struggle to compete has become more a fight for survival. The very existence of Prince Edward Island as a province within Confederation may be in jeopardy within a very few years if we cannot reverse the present trend." In the Legislative Assembly, the alignment was tight and would grow even tighter in 1969-70. What changed most during 1969 was the political rhetoric. Attention shifted away from the relative youthfulness of Alex Campbell and his team, and away from the record of the Shaw government, notably with the report of the Georgetown Commission of Inquiry in August 1969. The focus was now on a mature government marshalling the forces, ironing out the details, and maintaining the pace required to implement a program of substantive change. The greatest challenge would be to communicate to Prince Edward Islanders the scale and details of the envisaged programs and reforms, and to negotiate the process of change. A near-term feature of that challenge would be an election, expected in 1970.
Political tightrope.
Campbell's sense of enthusiasm for the development plan and urgency to roll out its programs were not matched by the opposition in the legislature. During the 1969 throne speech debate, Progressive Conservative House Leader Walter Shaw referred to Campbell as the Prophet Alexander and questioned the government's ability to predict what would happen on PEI 10 or 15 years in the future, saying, "This isn't a mathematical calculation." Shaw objected to the way the plan was formulated and that so many people from outside the province had been involved. He predicted that rationalization in agriculture and the fishery would lead to a decline in the population of the province. George Key, who had been selected as Progressive Conservative leader at a convention in September 1968, did not have a seat in the legislature and observed events from outside the rail. The biggest legislative threat to the Campbell government came not from the opposition, but from within its own caucus. Keir Clark was a successful merchant and businessman and a philosophical conservative. In cabinet, he expressed concerns about the left-leaning direction of the plan, the increased cost and scope of government, the expansion of bureaucracy, and reliance on experts. As the cabinet confirmed its commitment to the policies and scope of the plan, Clark remained unconvinced. On one occasion, when Campbell called a rare Saturday afternoon cabinet meeting, Clark objected. Protesting that he had a business to run, Clark indicated that he would be in his store in Montague on Saturday. Campbell asked the cabinet to meet in the office above the store. In February 1969, Keir Clark resigned his cabinet post, letting it be known that he was not in agreement with aspects of the plan and voicing objection to the role of the Economic Improvement Corporation. Campbell issued a statement praising Clark's contributions, and Bruce Stewart was named Minister of Health and Municipal Affairs. Clark continued to sit as a Liberal MLA, but it was clear that he was not content. During debate on the 1969 budget, he expanded upon his criticism of the plan, saying, "I am one who believes strongly in the limitation of government participation to those things which governments can do best, and to the encouragement of private initiative in all areas." In March 1970, Clark crossed the floor to sit as an independent, by now strongly critical of the Liberals as the party of the plan. Over and above the fact that his move across the floor deprived the government of its slim majority, Liberals were offended by Clark's personal criticism of Campbell. In his diary, Elmer Blanchard termed Clark's speech a malicious and vicious attack on the Premier and the development plan. 2 days later, Blanchard had dinner in Montague with Gilbert Clements, who would replace Clark as MLA for the 4th King's District after the 1970 election. Blanchard noted in his diary, "Even Gilbert, who is a close friend of Keir, is mad as blazes." Alex Campbell did not make any public criticism of Clark. In private, he was calm and philosophical, separating the personal from the political. More than 40 years later, Campbell reflected on the matter in the following terms.
"You know, Wade, in Ireland politics, you were born into the Liberal Party. That meant that the whole spectrum of political leanings and philosophies was linked together biologically in the party. It meant that you had the George Prouds, right out of the labor movement, the Bob Campbells from the fishing ports, and Keir Clark from the conservative right wing, all as buddies and a fellow liberal. Keir gave his reasons on the record. For me, that was the first and thankfully the last of departures on a matter of significant disagreement on policy. Through the whole piece, there was never a mean word exchanged between us. I respected him."
The government managed to complete the 1970 session of the legislature on its own terms. On March 26th, Campbell rose following the opening prayer to announce that he had visited Lieutenant Governor McKay and obtained assent for the dissolution of the House for an election to take place on May 11th.
Political intelligence.
For the 1970 election, the Liberal campaign team recognized that they required better information about the opinions of Prince Edward Islanders. Ned Béliveau brought in Ben Crowe, a Toronto-based public opinion expert and marketing consultant. For 8 days in early April, Crowe had 23 researchers conduct intensive one-on-one interviews with 210 people throughout Prince Edward Island. While the sample was small, this was among the richest political intelligence to be developed in Canada up to this time, going well beyond the probable voting intentions of the electorate. Crowe's report to the campaign team included findings on Islanders' attitudes toward change, their way of life, the economy, and a myriad of substantive issues. Crowe reported to the Liberal campaign team, "There is a conflicting set of attitudes about the past, present, and future economics of the province. By and large, there is concern about a host of economic issues. This economic concern is the jarring note in the pastoral symphony." He found a strong correlation between economic attitudes and voting behavior, with Liberals and Liberal-leaning voters being more inclined to view economic conditions positively. The element of Crowe's work that most directly affected the Liberals' 1970 campaign concerned the Comprehensive Development Plan. He reported that the plan has not caught the attention or imagination of the people, and that it is approved by some but is considered a threat by many, especially to the basic lifestyle. Crowe went on to tell Liberal organizers, "More than one-third of the people cannot provide any item of detail or explanation about the plan. A large minority can nevertheless respond emotionally to it and are susceptible to demagoguery. Negative concepts about the plan relate to the threat the plan poses to the basic lifestyle of the province. In addition, there is a sting to pride that outside people and money are required. Crowe provided other critical insights about points on which substantial proportions of the electorate harbor a number of prejudicial and emotionally charged opinions, as follows. 1. The causeway was sacrificed to the development plan. 2. There is resentment about the employment of outsiders to prepare the plan in secret and without the consultation of the resident population. The resentment is particularly keen about the outsiders being highly paid eggheads without practical experience. 3. Socialist experiments have no place in the province. The plan is considered to be such an experiment by some people, especially conservatives. 4. Consolidation of farmlands is resisted strongly by all voter groups. 5. That a plan was necessary to cure the economic ills of the province is disputed. 6. There is impatience with planning and a demand for action. 7. There is an entrenched resistance to change. 8. Although not liked, change is recognized as a necessary evil. Crowe's ultimate findings concerned likely electoral outcomes. In interviews conducted during the second week of the campaign, he found that there was a very high awareness level of the leaders, candidates, and election date. Further, Premier Campbell had a stronger and more favorable image than Conservative leader George Key, and Campbell was running ahead of the Liberal Party in imagery. He found, the Premier also projects a paternalistic image which is appreciated on the island. The main perceived weakness for Premier Campbell and the Liberal Party was an association with planning rather than action, even though the overall image is one of activity.
The 1970 campaign.
The Liberal organization was in better shape than it was going into the 1966 election. Summerside businessman Mike Schurman was surprised when Andy Wells asked him to be campaign chair, but he took it on with gusto, including changing his role within the family construction firm to relocate to Charlottetown and run operations there. This move came with an apartment above the Schurman store on Longworth Avenue, which became a discreet hotbed and brain trust for party strategy and electoral operations. Schurman recalls, "We'd order in Chinese food from the Canton Cafe. We had a great group of people. We were laughing and carrying on and partying. It was fun." The core group at the Longworth Avenue apartment comprised Schurman, Andy Wells, and Sid Green. Ned Beliveau came back for the 1970 election, and his son Bill became involved in strategic communications, a role that the younger Beliveau continued throughout the Campbell years. Jack McAndrew was there on occasion, as was Liberal Party Director Bill Morrison. Alex Campbell joined the group from time to time. Schurman says, "I didn't say much about policy. They'd decide and I'd execute." Alex was the prime policy developer, along with Andy. He was principal. And Ned, of course. Ned ensured that we stayed on message. Equipped with the background data from Ben Crowe's surveys, the campaign team presented Campbell in an active milieu, which Crowe recommended should be with working class people and farmers. The campaign made no reference to planning or to the development plan in general terms. Crowe urged physical illustration of active implementation. He also recommended that Campbell should be presented in a paternalistic manner and that Campbell should attempt to recognize islanders and instill pride. George Key unveiled his party's platform first, with a central plank calling for the renegotiation of the development plan on more favorable terms, and a promise to press for the New Brunswick-Prince Edward Island Causeway, together with the elimination of ferry tolls until such time as the causeway was constructed. The Liberals revealed their platform a week later, in effect seeking a mandate to proceed. The following day, there were full-page ads featuring a letter from Premier Campbell, with his signature and a youthful but paternalistic photo of Campbell occupying two-thirds of the page. Subsequent ads focused on specific areas or sectors, such as agriculture, highways, housing, or healthcare, with details of programs and specific benefits, while always featuring Campbell. The Conservatives made persistent efforts to cast doubt on the plan as being ill-founded, outworn, and a bad financial deal. Their most enthusiastic critique was aimed at the experts, planners, and bureaucrats. George Key said they were in control of the island's destiny. He said of the plan, "It's a deal conceived by Ottawa Mandarins, and it is they, not your elected representatives, who will decide your future." While the Conservatives aimed their rhetoric at the most vulnerable aspects of the development plan, they were in the ironic position of offering greater uncertainty by promising that the plan would be renegotiated. The Liberals' campaign slogan played on this uncertainty, calling upon Prince Edward Islanders to be sure of your future. The 1970 campaign differed from 1966 in its degree of centralized organization. Mike Skurman explains, "We set up this office down there and we ran it. If the district wanted something that wasn't part of the program, no way, they didn't get it." The other big difference was the size and composition of crowds. Campbell recalled that the people who came out to meetings in the winter of 1966 were die-hard, committed party faithful. During the 1970 campaign, the audiences were half male and half female, and there was a tremendous involvement by young people. On the Friday before the election, the Liberal campaign held a 5,000-person wind-up rally at the Kennedy Coliseum in Charlottetown, preceded by an island-wide motorcade. The crowd at the Chile Coliseum was warmed up by Anne Murray, Gene McClellan, and the Clancy brothers. The Conservatives wrapped up with a Summerside rally estimated at 1,500 people. The Saturday evening before voting day saw the biggest innovation of the campaign, a one-hour televised debate between Campbell and Key. The tension in the debate showed as much in the long-standing friendship of the two men, who lived on the same block in Summerside and whose families had shared vacations, as in the contrasting positions of the two parties. In either case, they weren't far apart. The choice facing voters was between proceeding with the development plan as presented by the Campbell government and giving the Conservatives a mandate to try to improve upon it. In the one-on-one debate format, Campbell shone. On Monday, May 11th, 87.32% of the PEI electorate turned out to vote. Alex Campbell's Liberals were returned with an historic level of popular support. Prince Edward Island elections were traditionally decided by margins in the single digits. The Liberals won 49% of popular support in both 1962 and 1966. In 1970, they received 58.4% of votes cast, which remains a record in PEI politics. This translated into 27 Liberal seats in the legislature to 5 for the opposition Progressive Conservatives. Day after, assessments by political observers agreed that the decisive victory was an endorsement of the development plan, that Alex Campbell had shown much more platform poise than in 1966, and that the Premier's personal popularity had been a factor in the outcome. Youth were a significant factor in the 1970 election, with almost 20% of the PEI electorate eligible to vote for the first time. Alex Campbell went out of his way to engage young people from the time he became party leader. As a founding member of the PEI Young Liberals in 1959, he understood the importance of the organization, which was rejuvenated in 1967-68. Gerard Mitchell, who was elected president of the Young Liberals in late 1967, says that young people had the feeling that they were being paid attention. Alex Campbell was young, vigorous, and good-looking, and there were well-attended youth rallies. Campbell didn't take the youth vote for granted. He was sensitive to the fact that youth resisted deliberate efforts by others to organize them. Moreover, they were not just looking to become the next generation of party faithful. Campbell remarked, "The young people had no particular interest in hearing which party was better than the other. They wanted to know what we were going to do and seemed to reserve the right to decide on the basis of what they heard from both Liberal and Conservative meetings." The second significant advantage enjoyed by the Liberals in 1970 was the caliber of candidates they put forward, combining effective constituency politicians, vote-getters, and front-bench strength. Many observers contend that the cabinet named by Alex Campbell following the 1970 election was the strongest in PEI history, while 7 of the MLAs who did not make cabinet in 1970, Bennett Campbell, Gilbert Clements, Arthur MacDonald, Gene Canfield, Bud Ings, Eddie Clark, and William Gallant, would play roles in future ministries. All members of Campbell's pre-election cabinet were returned, with Cecil Miller becoming Speaker of the Legislative Assembly. Two newcomers were added to the 1970 cabinet. Robert Bob Skurman brought oratorical and entrepreneurial experience, given his background as a broadcaster and owner of Summerside radio station CJRW. He became Minister of Municipal Affairs, renamed Community Services shortly thereafter. Skurman would subsequently take on additional roles as Minister of Environment and Tourism and Chair of the 1973 Centennial Commission. The other newcomer was Dr. John Maloney, who came from a different mold than most politicians. He was an impatient intellectual and community leader who was not afraid to speak his mind. As a leader of the effort to create a single university, Maloney told audiences that it was time to bring down this wall of bigotry. As a busy obstetrician and gynecologist, and an accomplished historian, amateur archaeologist, and philosopher who disliked spring elections because of the amount of dog excrement encountered in voters' yards, Maloney might have been expected to have difficulty adapting to politics. He would become an effective minister and a leading intellectual contributor for the balance of the Campbell years. He was named Minister of Health in 1970 and would subsequently serve as Minister of Social Services, Industry, and Development.
Structural change, economic acceleration.
In his February 1969 television address, Alex Campbell emphasized the urgent need for the Comprehensive Development Plan, going so far as to say that Prince Edward Island's existence as a province could be in jeopardy. For Campbell, the statistic that most supported his sense of urgency was the fact that of Prince Edward Island's 6,000 farmers, only 1,100 were earning net income of more than $2,500 per year. Further, he told Islanders that in the previous 20 years, the number of farms has been drastically reduced here, just as it has been all over Canada. People were getting out of farming because they were unable to compete and because they could make a better living with considerably less risk by pursuing other opportunities. Campbell explained that PEI differed from other provinces which had a diversity of sectors able to take up the slack caused by the exodus from agriculture. He cautioned, "We are not rich in a variety of resources, therefore we must work with what we have available." In the simplest terms, that was the economic strategy behind the CDP. The Canadian and Prince Edward Island economies were restructuring in response to competitive forces and new opportunities. PEI could either get out ahead of that process or be crushed by it. Prince Edward Island had a veritable growth spurt during the second half of Alex Campbell's premiership. The provincial economy accelerated with a phenomenal 26% GDP increase in 1973, followed by a further 12.5% in 1974. These gains included inflation. For the decade of the 1970s, Prince Edward Island had the third strongest performing economy in Canada, after Alberta and British Columbia. Behind these results lay an ambitious program of substantive administrative and institutional reforms and restructuring. Most of all, Prince Edward Island's heady GDP performance during these years reflected innovation, investment, and entrepreneurial initiative in the private sector, plus innumerable calculated risks and decisions, both heart-wrenching and optimistic by individuals and families. It is telling that Prince Edward Island had an unprecedented turn to in-migration for a seven-year period from 1972 to 1978, and that the provincial unemployment rate fell below 10% for a six-year stretch starting in 1973. The cradle was rocking.
Tourism.
While the Comprehensive Development Plan embraced agriculture as PEI's economic engine and cornerstone of development, it was not the only sector targeted. Tourism got the jump on other sectors in the late summer of 1968, when the federal government, recognizing that CDP negotiations were dragging on, agreed to advance funds to develop the Brudenell Golf Course and Resort, as well as for upgrades at the Wood Islands Ferry Terminal. The Brudenell Resort was intended as a destination facility in Kings County to attract travelers to visit parts of the island other than Charlottetown and the National Park beaches at Cavendish, Brackley, and Stanhope. It was followed by the Mill River development in West Prince, starting with a golf course in 1970 and resort facilities in the mid-1970s. Tourism didn't represent a substantial part of the island economy until the 1960s, following rapid growth in the previous decade. The annual number of tourist visitors was only 35,000 at the beginning of the 1950s and grew to 208,000 by a decade later, and tripled again during the decade of the 1960s to reach 573,000 visitors in 1970. This frenetic level of activity was urged on by Tourism Development Minister Lorne Bonnell, who didn't hesitate to take credit or to predict further growth. In a 1970 interview, Bonnell said that the tourism industry was still in swaddling clothes and projected a doubling of direct revenues every 5 years to reach $40 million by 1975 and $80 million by 1980. As things turned out, after 1970, growth in tourist visitations flattened out, reaching a high of 583,000 in 1976. Revenues reached 30 million in direct revenue in 1975 and 43.5 million by 1980, just over half the level predicted by Bunnell. Between 1970 and 1978, tourism revenues increased by less than half the rate of growth for the overall PEI economy. A 1976 study of the impacts of tourism on Prince Edward Island found that the great majority of tourists continued to favor the traditional areas and the peak summer months. Moreover, it found that going to the beach and sightseeing were the favorite activities, with golf attracting not more than 10% of travelers. The tourism controversy in which Alex Campbell became most directly involved was the proposal to create a new national park in eastern Kings County. The concept, which had been under discussion in federal and provincial bureaucratic circles since a 1964 Joint Shoreline study, was promised by both Liberals and Conservatives in the 1966 election and came to the fore along with many other promises during the first King's deferred election. With the federal government's agreement in 1970 that Comprehensive Development Plan funds could be used to acquire the necessary land, the Eastern Kings Park concept moved to the front burner, with the province taking the lead in land acquisition. The park proposal encountered widespread confusion and concern, notably regarding how it would affect the lives and livelihoods of local residents. The confusion started with a difference in outlook between the two levels of government. Federal officials favored a conventional wilderness park, while the province promoted a new model, which would see primary sector activities and community life continue as cultural features of the park. In March 1973, Premier Campbell tabled a status report on the park, following which he led a series of public meetings organized by the Rural Development Council in Eastern Kings communities. At each meeting, he presented a slideshow depicting what would happen to the area under private development and what would take place if the proposed national park were established. Campbell made the case that the park would preserve the landscape and the way of life, styled as the cultural landscape. At the conclusion of the third meeting at St. Columba Hall in Fairfield, Campbell recognized that the people remained unconvinced. He dramatically tore up the federal-provincial park agreement in front of the crowd and declared that any further action on the proposal would have to come from the people themselves, to which they responded with a resounding ovation and a collective letter of appreciation.
Fisheries.
The Comprehensive Development Plan characterized the PEI fishing industry as having a number of serious problems, including limited fishing stocks, too many small, poorly equipped ports, too many fishermen with low average incomes, and too many processing plants, most of which were inefficient and lacking in capital investment, technology, and management. Much as it did with agriculture, the development plan looked on the PEI fishery as a sector requiring productivity gains and consolidation. It set the ambitious objective of raising the net value of production per worker in the PEI fishery to more than $9,000 annually by the end of the 15-year plan period. This would be achieved by a smaller number of fishermen operating out of a smaller number of better-equipped ports. The development plan's designated port policy attracted a lot of negative attention, especially concern that ports that were not designated would fall behind or be abandoned. Critics suggested that as many as 50 PEI harbors would close. Campbell denied that this was the case. He told a Liberal district meeting in November of 1969, "God put fishing ports there, and Alex and Cecil will not take them away." The reference to Cecil was Cecil Miller, Minister of Industry, Fisheries and Natural Resources. In February 1970, in a major policy address to the PEI Fisheries Federation, Campbell unveiled a 15-year program to build up and expand 20 primary ports, while retaining the remaining secondary ports at their current levels. Campbell declared, "There was never any question of closing down, phasing out, or forcing fishermen away from the ports not named as ones for expansion." The designated port policy led to substantial investments in wharf improvements, dredging, ice-making facilities, bait sheds, and other infrastructure at harbors with a higher volume of traffic, but there were few ports closed. Starting in the early 1970s, provincial and federal officials worked with fishermen to form port committees that would eventually become harbor authorities. These bodies exerted political pressure to secure port improvements and maintenance in large and small harbors. As many as 28 harbors were eventually designated, with another 7 or 8 informally contending to keep up with the higher standard, even as the designated port policy itself was downplayed. The fishery workforce was not substantially reduced, although a modest number of fishermen, primarily those who were averaging small catches, eventually accepted buyouts or left the industry by choice. The 1983 Kirby report found that there were 3,200 fishermen on PEI and another 2,000 people working in processing plants. This compared with the same number of fishermen in 1966 and with 470 plant workers 15 years earlier. The plan's suggestion that some fishing families might be relocated to other ports was ignored and eventually ditched. Campbell made it clear to the Joint Advisory Board in February 1975 that the province did not support the concept and that fishermen viewed it as unnecessary and unacceptable. The most significant rationalization in the fishery came through barriers to entry resulting from escalating costs of bigger boats, more powerful engines, new labor-saving technologies and navigational aids, and fancier traps and nets. Combined with rising operating expenses, such as fuel, labor, supplies, and bait, this meant that even though they were visibly doing better, PEI fishermen had a lot more at stake. A further cost of doing business for new fishermen came when the federal government implemented a policy of limited entry licensing, starting with the maritime lobster fishery in 1967 and extending to the entire Atlantic fishery after 1973. Between 1966 and 1971, the lobster fishery saw the phased introduction of trap limits, which meant a substantial reduction in the number of traps being fished without any perceptible impact on the size of the catch. The biggest technological innovation may have been the introduction of a simple escape hatch mechanism, which provincial officials helped to design. David Junker, who worked with provincial fisheries in extension and research, estimates that 150,000 of these devices were distributed to island lobster fishermen by 1978, making a major contribution to stock conservation and subsequent increases in lobster landings. In conjunction with increased carapace sizes, improved self-policing on the part of fishermen, and the depletion of natural predators such as cod. The landed value of PEI's catch from all fisheries rose from $6.4 million in 1966 to $24.6 million in 1978, almost a fourfold increase. The overall spin-off effects of the fishery were considerable in terms of employment, capital investments in vehicles, boats, technology and equipment, and spending in rural communities, plus labor force retention for other seasonal work, such as tourism, agriculture, or construction. It is said that a good rule of thumb for the total value of the fishery and the PEI economy is three times the landed value of the catch. In the 1960s and 1970s, deep-sea fishing excursions became a source of supplemental earnings for fishermen and a popular addition to activities available for tourists. The two biggest innovations in terms of the catch were the discovery of bluefin tuna off the PEI North Shore starting in 1967, first used for pet food until 1974 when they were sold at premium prices in Japanese fish markets, and the conversion of the blue mussel from an underfoot nuisance to one of Prince Edward Island's most recognized food brands starting in the late 1970s. Lobster continued to comprise two-thirds of the total value of the PEI fishery throughout the period. The development plan's fisheries initiatives did not proceed at the same pace as those in tourism or agriculture. In part, this reflected the province's limited constitutional jurisdiction, as well as the fact that many of the plan's projected initiatives, such as harbour improvements or license buyback programs, were pursued with federal funding from other sources. In some cases, federal initiatives practically conflicted with the plan's objectives. Rather than a consolidation of processing facilities, there was a rapid expansion. This reflected the availability of DREE grants, local job creation politics, and rivalries among industry competitors to gain or retain market share. An internal report for the PEI government in May of 1971 recommended the creation of a rationalization fund for processing facilities. In 1973, an external review characterized rationalization of the fisheries workforce as a complete failure so far, notably because the policy counted on the availability of alternate employment opportunities. Notwithstanding the province's urgings, a lobster license buyback project was not instituted until 1977. With the federal government picking up 90% of the cost, there were 187 lobster licenses bought back and retired. In the 1960s and 1970s, unemployment insurance transfers became a significant and dependable supplement to the fishing economy, following the expansion of the scope of the program in 1956 to include self-employed fishermen. With enhanced benefits and expanded coverage taking effect in the mid-1970s, the program took on even greater importance for the seasonal fishery. By 1978, total unemployment insurance transfers to PEI recipients, including fishermen, totaled $45.5 million, which was equal to 454,000 weeks of paid benefits. This crucial income supplement was probably more responsible than any other factor for the relative stability in the fishery, compared with the exodus from agriculture. It wasn't easy for a productive fisherman to find year-round work on PEI that combined the same economic returns, independence, and expertise. As a premier who preferred to leave ministers and departments to run their own affairs, there weren't many occasions when Alex Campbell was required to take the lead role in fisheries matters, such as he did with the designated ports policy in February 1970. Louis Creed, who joined government in 1970 as a graduate of the first class from UPEI, thinks of Alex Campbell as the first premier who would sit down in front of the TV camera and explain that the world wasn't going off the rails. George Henderson, who became minister in 1974 after his first election as an MLA, recalls that things were really starting to happen in fisheries after the mid-1970s, with port development, better equipment, improved techniques for handling fish, and enhanced conservation. Henderson led a period of aquaculture development, building on his background in oyster research. The big growth would be in mussel aquaculture, where Joe Vandenbrandt and other pioneers overcame obstacles to capture and grow spat, create licensing regimes, and build markets for Prince Edward Island blue mussels. Whatever the innovations, the fishery remained subject to the forces of supply and demand. George Henderson recalls that his first months as minister in 1974 were preoccupied with buying up excess frozen and processed lobster inventory, followed by an energetic effort through the Market Development Center to sell the lobster in Boston and New York.
Agriculture.
The Comprehensive Development Plan embraced agriculture as the base of the economy of Prince Edward Island. Building on the findings of the Canada Land Inventory that PEI had a substantial amount of high-quality land available for expansion, the development plan adopted the view that structural and social adjustments were required to use the island's agricultural resources more fully. The plan aimed for the net value added from agriculture to double by 1976 and triple by 1983, calling for an initial 7-year period of restructuring, followed by a period of rapid growth. Most criticism focused on the CDP's position that this level of productivity could be achieved with just 2,500 commercial farm units. By 1969, Prince Edward Island's agricultural economy had already been through 4 decades of restructuring. The proportion of the island labor force working on farms dropped from 63% in 1931 to 12.5% in 1971. Moreover, during the same 40 years, 8,300 farms went out of business, representing more than two-thirds of the farming operations that existed on the island in 1931. Between 1971 and 1976, another 860 farms, or almost 20% of the farms operating in 1971, would disappear, mostly consolidated into larger operations. In the 4 decades following 1931, the number of acres farmed on Prince Edward Island declined from almost 1.2 million to 775,000, evidence that rationalization was a reality long before the Comprehensive Development Plan. Critics said that the development plan forced people out of farming. A conservative advertisement during the 1970 election campaign predicted that the plan would destroy many family farms, force families to leave their homesteads, and cause unnecessary depopulation of the island. If anything, government programs likely helped to slow the rate of exodus and ease the way for those who wanted out. Still, by embracing fewer farms as a policy objective, the CDP tread on sacred ground. The 5 years from 1967 to 1971 were among the worst in history for Prince Edward Island farmers. They earned a total net income of only $40 million in 5 years. Agricultural net income in 1971 was the lowest it had been since 1934, and worse in real dollar terms than during the depths of the Great Depression. PEI farm income in 1971 amounted to $227 per person. Things turned out much better thereafter. For the 5 years from 1972 to 76, Island farm net income totaled $146 million, which was a 350% improvement over the previous half decade. On the face of things, the development plan appeared to be working. Notwithstanding grim economic times in agriculture and the fact that people were getting out of farming anyway, often painfully, the development plan programs encountered resistance. Potato farmer and equipment manufacturer Donnie Allen recalls a well-attended meeting in York, at which Alex Campbell went on and on about the need for farms to get bigger. Allen says that when Campbell finished speaking, a small farmer who was known for speaking his mind asked, "Well, if you couldn't make any money on 35 acres, why would you want 100? Allen says, "Everybody in the room was thinking that, but no one was crazy enough to say it." National Farmers Union Vice President Stuart Affleck told the December 1969 meeting in Pownall that farmers might have to resort to militancy to achieve their just objectives, questioning the call for increased production when farmers lacked the power to set prices. Government proceeded quickly with measures to implement the development plan's agricultural policies, notably the establishment of the Land Development Corporation. As Canada's first agricultural land bank, the LDC facilitated the transfer of land between farmers looking to exit the industry and those wanting to scale up. For the seller, it offered options such as the ability to stay in the farm home or to receive an annuity or pension. For those looking to acquire farmland, the LDC offered a variety of leasing arrangements. The Land Development Corporation programs were popular, and it was not long before the corporation acquired more than 100,000 acres. As a measure of how active things were on the public policy front, on the same day that Alex Campbell announced the creation of the LDC, he also announced the creation of the Natural Products Marketing Centre. The PEI Lending Authority was established, consolidating several existing lending programs and adding capacity. To ensure that financing was available to farmers and fishermen, government provided $1 million to the credit unions to assist with short-term loans. Notwithstanding these initiatives and early momentum, it was apparent by mid-1971 that the development plan programs were not meeting with universal acceptance, and that many farmers were still struggling to make a living and to understand the direction of public policy or the agricultural industry. For Alex Campbell, the summer and fall of 1971 would be a turning point.
Summer 1971, dissent and demonstration.
In the summer of 1971, with Prince Edward Island farmers experiencing one of the worst years on record, the NFU was restive. Its members commenced staging tractor demonstrations during Old Home Week, delaying the start of the Gold Cup and Saucer Parade and disrupting parade traffic. The focus of highway demonstrations shifted to Borden on August 18th, with NFU members setting up an afternoon blockade on the Trans-Canada Highway. The demonstrations were ostensibly over unsuccessful attempts to organize a meeting with Premier Campbell, who said that Agriculture Minister Dan MacDonald would meet with the NFU at any time. When Jean Marchand visited PEI on August 18th, the NFU staged demonstrations, including a 500-person gathering in Summerside. Premier Campbell and Marchand avoided the demonstrators, at one point traveling by helicopter, which further irritated NFU activists. Agriculture Minister Dan MacDonald held a press conference on August 19th, reiterating that he was available to discuss matters with the NFU. They didn't take him up on the offer, as they wanted nothing less than a meeting with Premier Campbell. Campbell made a radio address at 7:45 a.m. on August 20th, emphasizing 3 points. 1, that he shared the NFU's concern about national and international conditions that are creating agricultural problems within our province. 2, that government was prepared to listen to any reasoned and responsible approach to achieve solutions to these problems. And 3, as Campbell said, government cannot and will not respond to ultimatums or tactics based on harassment or coercion. At the heart of his radio address, Campbell made clear why he would not bend to the demonstrations, explaining, "The National Farmers Union is attempting to dictate to the elected government of Prince Edward Island the terms on which you will be allowed to use your highways." He emphasized, "All the mechanisms of democracy are available to the National Farmers Union and other groups in Prince Edward Island. Our doors are open to any citizen or group of citizens who wish to place before their government positive and workable proposals to improve their position in life and that of their fellow citizens." On August 20th, the farmers blockaded the Borden Ferry Terminal and tied up the adjacent Trans-Canada Highway with slow-moving tractors, farm equipment, and vehicles, bringing late-season tourists and all other traffic to a standstill and forcing CN ferries to abandon operations. The demonstrators made an agreement with the RCMP to allow the backlog of motor vehicles to leave the area. On the evening of August 20th, Attorney General Gordon Bennett ordered RCMP to clear the highway. The following day at noon, five members of the NFU, including National President Roy Atkinson, linked hands and formed a human chain across the Trans-Canada Highway. Atkinson was arrested briefly and released on bail after being charged with the criminal offense of conspiracy to intimidate. While public opinion was against the tractor demonstrations, there were expectations that the Premier would help to find a compromise. A Journal Pioneer editorial called the blockade morally wrong, but said the government had won an empty victory. The editorial concluded, "Positions have been too firmly taken for any kind of back down to be easy. Yet something must be done, and the people are looking to the Premier to do it." The Guardian editorial said that the Premier's stand was the proper one, while concluding, "The door to negotiation is open, but it can't be entered astride a tractor." Wayne Easter, who was a 22-year-old North Wilshire farmer in his early days as an NFU youth director, and who would later serve 11 years as the NFU's national president, says, "I still run into people who give me shit for tying up the traffic. Not so much about the ferries as about keeping them from getting to Old Home Week." Alex Campbell didn't wait long to reach out. On August 23rd, he and Agriculture Minister Dan MacDonald invited the NFU and the Federation of Agriculture to a joint meeting. The NFU declined, proposing third-party mediation. In mid-October, the charges against Atkinson and his fellow protesters were dismissed at a preliminary hearing by Provincial Magistrate W. Chester S. MacDonald, who concluded that there was little chance of a conviction. The following day, Atkinson, along with PEI NFU Director Urban Lachlan and National Women's President Evelyn Potter, met discreetly with the Premier at Campbell's house in Summerside. In interviews 30 years later, Atkinson and Potter recalled that they found Campbell sensitive and emotional, with Atkinson adding, "I think Alex was really working hard to try and develop an economy on Prince Edward Island. I don't have anything negative to say about Alex, and I think, given the situation, probably the advice he was getting and what was going on was absolutely haywire." Campbell went on to build good relationships with NFU leaders. Wayne Easter recalls one meeting at which we had given the Premier shit, likely, after which Campbell offered to drive him back to his truck, which was parked several blocks away. Easter said, "I've never forgotten it to this day. I was 22 or 23. Alex was driving the car and chatting away, not about the meeting. This was quite something, driving in the car with the Premier." Easter would go on to be elected multiple times as a Liberal MP, and NFU Director Alison Ellis would become a Liberal MLA, first elected with Campbell in 1978. Urban Lachlan says that Campbell was the best Minister of Agriculture that he dealt with, starting with the fact that you were also talking to the Premier. Stuart Affleck, who served as the NFU's National Junior President, agrees. He recalls that Campbell would schedule meetings at the Linkletter Motel in Summerside, saying that he only had 30 minutes, in case he needed an excuse to leave. However, the meetings would go on for 2 hours. Even Roy Atkinson came to be on reasonable terms with Campbell, to the point of being invited to the cottage at Stanley Bridge for a private lobster dinner.
Listening and adjusting.
On October 18, 1971, Alex Campbell announced that he was embarking on a 2-week Meet the People tour. He said that the summer of 1971 may well be recalled as one of the most significant of island history if we learn from it and apply the lessons learned to the challenges which confront us. Campbell conceded that government had, in his words, no divine wisdom that enables us to make infallible judgment, and offered that he and his colleagues bore a heavy responsibility to be responsive to the needs and desires of the citizens, both collectively as a province and as individuals. In indicating his readiness and desire to learn, Campbell did not step back from the need for change, reminding islanders that they had voted for him to carry out changes designed to achieve greater social and economic development of the island and its citizens. Campbell said that government was striving to, in his words, channel change into a constructive restructuring of our society. We must control change. It must not control us. Between October 18th and November 2nd, Campbell met with fishermen and farmers on wharves and farms, went into school classrooms, and stopped at stores, restaurants, and construction projects. He listened and debated, thanking people for their hospitality and the frankness of their views. In the course of 2 weeks, Campbell produced 5 thoughtful papers, which were open, sincere, and optimistic, at the same time as they were challenging. The most comprehensive of which was titled The Adventure of Change, inviting islanders to embrace change as a means to progress. Other papers dealt with forthcoming changes in property taxation and education. At the completion of the tour, Campbell made a radio and television address in which he described his experience as a turning point. He told islanders that he found significant signs of progress and growing confidence in many sectors of the economy and society, but that there were problems, notably at the heart of our province in the agricultural industry.
Last evening, I completed visits to every corner of Prince Edward Island, which began on October the 18th. For more than 2 weeks, I have been talking with islanders from every walk of life, in homes, on farms, at fishing wharves, in stores, restaurants, and motels, in schools, at meetings, and on construction projects. I felt it was important to leave my office in Charlottetown and hear for myself the views of island citizens on matters affecting them and the future of their province. It was a refreshing and stimulating experience, which renewed my confidence in the ability of islanders to recognize the good occurring in the province and to identify pertinent problems.
Campbell went on to say that, while government had received many studies from economists, accountants, and public servants, none has offered the human solutions or economic remedies which farmers sought in equal measure. He concluded by announcing the formation of a Farmers' Committee on Agriculture, with a mandate to produce a realistic appraisal of the industry and its future, coupled with practical recommendations of the kind and extent of federal and provincial government assistance to support the industry and its efforts. The Farmers' Committee on Agriculture met at least monthly throughout the fall and winter of 1971-72 and continued meeting occasionally thereafter. The committee comprised upwards of 20 farmers, together with representatives of federal and provincial departments of agriculture. Premier Campbell and Agriculture Minister Dan MacDonald were regular participants. Not least in importance, this was the first time the government succeeded in having representatives of the Federation of Agriculture and the National Farmers Union meet together. There was no partisan posturing, as the committee members would try to hash things over and hammer out policy.
A new emphasis on agriculture.
The 1972 speech from the throne was devoted entirely to agriculture, promising programs to extend credit and capital grants to farmers, as well as incentives for farm improvement and expansion. The capstone was a major family farm program, under which qualified farmers could receive capital grants of up to $6,000 to cover 50% of the cost of improvements, of which not more than $3,000 would be paid in any 1 year. The speech identified agriculture as the foundation, direct and indirect, of Prince Edward Island's economy, declaring, "When that foundation is on a firm footing, the province's economic life is on a firm footing. When that foundation trembles, the province trembles." In early September, following Dan MacDonald's resignation to contest the Cardigan riding in the federal election, Alex Campbell took over as Minister of Agriculture and continued in that role until after the 1974 election. Another significant measure for Alex Campbell in his later days as Minister of Agriculture was the introduction of a Young Farmers Program, targeting incentives and educational programs, including on-the-job training, for farmers and potential farmers under 35 years of age. Recruiting the next generation was a perennial challenge for PEI agriculture, including succession on family farms. When the development plan was unveiled in 1969, 40% of island farmers were over 55 years of age. The 1974 program aimed to recruit 200 to 300 new farmers over a period of 5 years. The Campbell government encountered as many headaches with agricultural processing as it did with primary producers. Viability of the processing sector was a matter of concern, given that 70% of island manufacturing was food-related and that manufacturing jobs were needed for people leaving farms. In dairy processing, PEI went from being known as the Denmark of Canada, with almost 50 cheese and butter-making factories at the end of the 19th century, to having one major dairy manufacturer by the 1980s, with several smaller dairies throughout the province. The Campbell government facilitated a significant degree of consolidation of dairies during the 1960s and 1970s. Similarly, the vegetable and potato processing sector experienced turbulence, including financial challenges, changes of ownership, and continuously evolving technology. With the lessons learned from the Georgetown fiasco, the government refused to loan more than $2 million to a single company, a policy that would contribute to a further change of ownership at the largest processing plant at New Annan, when Irving Interests bought out C.M. McLean's in 1979. The big changes in agriculture were caused as much by investment and innovation by farmers as they were the result of government policies or programs. On July 1, 1974, Donnie Allen had 102 orders for truck boxes, harvesters, and potato handling equipment. Allen says, "There were so many farmers coming that they couldn't get in to see me. They had to come back early the next day." Farmers had cash in their pockets after a good year in 1973. Allen says that some people wanted the machines so badly that they took the pieces home and welded them together themselves. The Robinson family's potato operation in the Albany and Augustine Cove area offers a further illustration of how things were changing. In 1966, they farmed 200 acres of potatoes, already a big operation by the standards of the day. In 1971, they planted 1,200 acres and subsequently decided that the optimal level was 800 acres to achieve desired production volumes and crop rotation. Enhancing the scale of operations, including conversion from cellars and in-the-ground warehouses to new storage buildings with modern ventilation systems adjacent to the railway line. Land acquisition was not a barrier, with the exodus or retirement of people from smaller mixed farms facilitated by government programs. John Robinson recalls, "From our viewpoint, there was an unlimited amount of land. There was credit, and the banks were interested in lending. There were markets for everything you produced."
When tobacco farmer Joe Vandenbrempt of Greenfield PEI was named World Tobacco Champion in 1973, the title came with an elaborate gold and silver trophy valued at $15,000. When the organizers of the competition expressed reservations about allowing him to take the trophy home to PEI, Vandenbrempt protested, "I want it on the island." He went to see Premier Campbell, who had the trophy added to the government's insurance policy and a special display dome constructed at the farm center in Charlottetown. Vandenbrempt and his wife Agnes have fond memories of the unveiling, which was followed by an invitation to join Campbell for lunch. He recalls, "After lunch, Alex asked our boys Henry and John to come with him and said to us, 'You meet me at my office. I'm taking the boys for a ride.' He drove them all around town, sitting in the back of his car like a couple of big shots." Vandenbrempt treasures the memory as much as having the trophy for a year. He says not many people on PEI or anywhere can claim that they were driven around town on a sightseeing tour with the Premier as your chauffeur.
Alex Campbell was well regarded as Minister of Agriculture, although there were challenges, including testy moments with the National Farmers Union and the Federation of Agriculture. The gloves came off between the two organizations during plebiscites over potato marketing in the summer of 1972 and again in 1973, with farmers voting against proposed marketing schemes by narrow margins. Campbell was fortunate in his timing. The province's net farm income would reach $32 million in 1973 and $51 million in 1974. For a two-year total, that surpassed the combined earnings of the previous 9 years. In real dollar terms, 1974 would be the best year in history for Prince Edward Island farmers. These positive results reflected national and international market conditions, as well as increased sophistication and productivity on the part of island farmers, who were obviously benefiting from the fine-tuning of public policy. The results also showed that, as Premier and as Minister of Agriculture, Campbell was effective in pressing for change while listening sincerely and being willing to change course in response to his informed sense of the needs of farmers and of his province.
Junction 71 and the Public Gathering Act.
The dissent and demonstrations of the summer of 1971 were preceded by an improbable warm-up act that Alex Campbell concedes was not the most glorious moment of his premiership. Junction 71 was the brainchild of a group of three young local entrepreneurs who contracted national performers Bruce Coburn and Edward Baer, as well as regional acts such as Pepper Tree and Melody Fair, for a two-day music festival to take place at Parkdale's Kennedy Coliseum over the Easter weekend. Half of the proceeds were to be donated to the Easter Seals campaign. Church and community leaders mobilized in opposition to the event, with a group of 16 clergy representing various churches calling on government to stop the concert on the grounds that rock festivals elsewhere in Canada had, in their words, resulted in displays of exhibitionism and increased escapism by way of drugs. The Prince Edward Island Medical Society warned that the island lacked adequate facilities to deal with what they predicted would be an expected increase in medical problems, including drug reactions arising from an event of this nature. Petitions were circulated and sermons preached in the weeks leading up to the planned concert. While initially open to the concert, the town of Parkdale decided against issuing a permit. As Minister of Justice and Attorney General, and as MLA for the district that included the Kennedy Coliseum, Gordon Bennett was a special target for those opposing Junction 71. For government, the tipping point came with a presentation to Cabinet by Superintendent L.G. Pantry, commanding officer of the RCMP on PEI, who produced binders of sometimes lurid photographs and a 40-minute film, courtesy of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, depicting rock festivals such as the iconic Woodstock. The photographs featured nudity and open drug use and lots of mud. Pantry, who had been stationed in Washington, D.C. for 3 years prior to his PEI posting, predicted that Junction 71 would bring lawlessness and public disorder. More than 20 years later, with the declassification of RCMP documents in 1994, it would come to light that Pantry had made regular reports to RCMP headquarters in Ottawa on various groups on PEI, including university students and professors, trade unions, and the NFU. In a 1972 memo to RCMP headquarters, Pantry described the NFU as a known militant group, reporting that outside influences are being exerted on the rank and file, and particularly those of the uneducated classes. The Ottawa files even contained a copy of the UPEI academic calendar. Junction 71 inspired a series of reports to Ottawa from Pantry, including a step-by-step account of actions taken by the provincial government and a transcript of a panel interview with Alex Campbell and the festival's promoter. The PEI cabinet decided on Tuesday, April 6th, that the rock festival should be stopped or scaled back. On April 7th, a hastily drawn Bill 55, titled An Act for the Prohibition of Certain Public Gatherings, was introduced in the legislature and taken through all three readings in a single day, while MLAs perused the binders of photos compiled by the RCMP. The legislation empowered the Minister of Justice, with the approval of cabinet, to prohibit any public gathering which, in his opinion, may contribute to the disruption of public order. Vigorous political demonstrations against the Public Gatherings Act were mounted by student groups and the NFU, along with civil liberties advocates and concerned citizens. While initially deferential to the concerns of the clergy, editorial opinion turned against the government, and the issue was picked up by the national and international media, as well as bodies such as the Canadian Civil Liberties Union. For Alex Campbell, the controversy was brought home when two of his closest advisors, Andy Wells and Jack McAndrew, joined in the formation of a committee for the restoration of civil liberties. On the evening of April 7th, the always discreet Wells berated Campbell in the members' lobby of the legislature over the scope of the legislation and the decision of House Speaker Cecil Miller to close the public galleries to anyone who looked like a potential demonstrator while admitting gallery regulars. Campbell protested that the Legislative Assembly was under the jurisdiction of the Speaker, not the Premier. On April 8th, there was a further demonstration in Rochford Square opposite the Provincial Administrative Buildings. Campbell went out to mingle with the protesters. After Junction 71 went ahead as a scaled-back one-day event, with scant attendance and a significant financial loss to its organizers, Campbell acknowledged that the legislation was an overreaction. He announced that the law would be repealed during the fall session of the legislature and appointed a committee of citizens to offer advice on more constructive ways to regulate large gatherings. For Campbell, a further casualty came with Andy Wells' resignation in August to take up a 12-month posting as PEI's representative on the Secretariat of the Council of Maritime Premiers, partly motivated by Wells' feeling that a period of absence was required because he had publicly disagreed with Campbell.
Follow the money. CDP funding and provincial finances.
When the Comprehensive Development Plan was signed in March 1969, it was announced that Prince Edward Island would make plan-related expenditures of approximately $500 million. These provincial funds would be paired with federal contributions of $225 million over 15 years. In actuality, the numbers were much different. Provincial CDP inputs between 1969 and 1978 would be just over $138 million, coupled with $207.5 million in federal funds. These revised numbers reflected the fact that federal initiatives and funding from other programs in areas such as housing, fisheries, social programs, or transportation enabled the parties to supplement or redirect development plan resources, with a prime example being the redirection of fisheries funding to waterfront and urban redevelopment in Summerside and Charlottetown. The main reason for the substantial reduction in PEI's contribution was that the parties placed considerably less reliance than anticipated on provincial spending on education, which represented the most substantial component of the projected $500 million contribution in 1969. While education remained the province's top area of spending from 1966 to 1978, educational operating expenditures were not earmarked for development plan purposes. Although provincial CDP contributions were nominally less than projected, the increased scope and scale of government activity could not be achieved without enhanced revenues. The provincial sales tax rate was increased from 5% to 7% in 1969, following on 1968 changes to widen the sales tax base and raise taxes on alcohol and tobacco. The sales tax rate was raised again on July 1, 1971, to 8%. An equalized and centralized system of property taxation was introduced in 1971, with a province-wide rate of $1.10 per $1,000 of assessment for residential properties and $2.20 per $1,000 for businesses. In addition to enhanced provincial source revenues, there was a substantial increase in transfers from the federal government starting in 1967. As a proportion of total provincial revenues, federal transfers reached a high of 60% in 1976. The combined impact of enhanced federal funds and transfers, plus a strong PEI economy through the mid-1970s, meant balanced or surplus operating budgets for five consecutive years from 1970 to 1974. In the fall of 1972, Campbell announced that the government would reduce property tax rates and eliminate the estate tax. In November 1973, he announced a further reduction in property tax rates and sales tax exemptions on household goods, followed by a further tax reductions in the spring of 1974. These changes were enabled by a growing economy and enhanced federal transfers.
Front bench changes.
Shortly after the 1970 election, Alex Campbell suffered a painful loss from his formidable front bench team. While Campbell and a group of colleagues were on a tuna fishing outing aboard Bruce Stewart's boat out of North Lake, Elmer Blanchard succumbed to a fatal heart attack. Blanchard was in the chair when he hooked a giant bluefin tuna and fought it for more than a half hour before surrendering to exhaustion and retiring to the boat's cabin. For Campbell, Blanchard's untimely death marked the loss of a friend and cheerful colleague, as well as a capable cabinet minister. Bruce Stewart took over Blanchard's roles as Minister of Labor, Industry and Commerce, and Gordon Bennett became Minister of Justice and Attorney General. In November 1971, Campbell saw another departure with the appointment of Lorne Bunnell to the Senate. Bunnell was a prodigious worker and an experienced legislator, having won his first election in 1951 at the age of 28. He was Minister of Tourism Development during a time of significant growth in the sector, and as Minister of Welfare was famous for finding new ways to achieve leverage for the province under the Canada Assistance Act. While Bunnell had reconciled himself to the loss of the 1965 leadership contest, he was nonetheless an ambiguous team player, not least because he divided his time between a busy rural medical practice and his governmental roles. While it was Bunnell's initiative to seek the Senate seat, the appointment would not have gone ahead without Campbell's blessing. John Maloney had taken over the welfare role as Minister of Social Services after the 1970 election, and Bob Skuurman added tourism to his portfolio after Bunnell went to the Senate. In late summer of 1972, Campbell lost another key player when Agriculture Minister Dan MacDonald resigned to contest the Cardigan riding in the federal election. In one sense, this was a positive move for the provincial government, as there had not been a Liberal member of parliament from PEI since 1965. However, Dan MacDonald was not going to be easily replaced, for his first-hand knowledge of agriculture, his grassroots sense of the PEI community, and his straight-spoken wisdom. MacDonald always sat to Alex Campbell's right at the cabinet table, offering what Campbell called his good ear and sage advice. He went on to be one of Pierre Trudeau's favorites in cabinet and an effective regional minister. With the entire farming sector in a bad state and agriculture going through structural changes, Alex Campbell opted to assign himself the role of Minister of Agriculture, turning over the development portfolio to John Maloney. These changes were part of a larger cabinet shuffle that saw Bennett Campbell become Minister of Education, Robert Campbell step up to Minister of Fisheries, and Jean Canfield become Minister without portfolio responsible for the PEI Housing Authority. In January 1973, Campbell experienced the fourth significant loss to his front bench team in less than 30 months, with the sudden death of Robert Skuurman from a cerebral hemorrhage at the age of 47. Skuurman was a strong performer, who, in addition to his ministerial responsibilities in community services and environment and tourism, served as chairman of the 1973 Centennial Commission. His death brought tributes from all sides. Premier Campbell said that he felt a great sense of personal loss and expressed appreciation for Skuurman's public contributions, saying that in his cabinet roles, he knew no halfway measure. William Gallant took over Skuurman's ministerial roles, and Gordon Bennett became chair of the Centennial Commission. For Alex Campbell, these front bench changes represented a substantial turnover of his team during a period of intense governmental initiative, public debate, and controversy. To outward appearances, Campbell handled the changes and the losses with equanimity.
Popular rebound.
In mid-1972, Campbell learned that his government's popularity was in need of a boost. During the month of June, Ben Crowe conducted a survey of 214 islanders using the same comprehensive interview techniques as in 1970. The mid-1972 survey painted a challenging picture for Campbell's government. From a high of 58.4% of the popular vote in the 1970 election, the Liberals had declined to 48.8% by the June 1972 survey. This compared with 51.2% for the leaderless Conservatives. Crowe reported that the Liberals received their lowest ratings on whether they were perceived to be wanting to help all farmers or wanting to preserve the island way of life. While still running ahead of his party in popularity, Alex Campbell's biggest personal drawback was the perception that he was more for planning than action. Between mid-1972 and the fall of 1973, islanders saw and heard a lot from the Campbell government. In addition to the enhanced emphasis on agriculture, the Premier's speeches focused more on preserving and honouring the island way of life and traditions, together with its sense of place and advantages of scale. While Campbell didn't lose his spark of creativity, the messages of change were to be sung in a lower key and with a stronger PEI accent. The Liberals cut back significantly on mentioning the development plan in public, to the point where some people came to believe that it had been ditched. As Minister of Agriculture, Alex Campbell was visible and accessible to farmers. Other post-1972 priorities included the centennial celebration of PEI's entry into Confederation in 1973 and a new emphasis on land use and protection. The speech from the throne opening the 1973 session of the legislature was greeted with the headline, Promises Galore, with initiatives including an increased minimum wage, reduced and reformed property taxes, a study for a new central referral hospital, a new legal aid system, a new marketing system for potatoes, and action to follow up on the recommendations of the Royal Commission on Land Use. An editorial praised the speech for being an impressive document. Beyond the policy initiatives, public opinion of the Liberal government was boosted by a more robust economy. In September 1973, Ben Crowe did his third survey of PEI political attitudes. He found that the Liberals had risen from 48.8% of popular support in June 1972 to 57.2% less than 15 months later. This was a dramatic recovery, obviously reflecting a change of rhetoric and substantive programs, as well as an upturn in economic fortunes. Economic times were described as very good or fairly good by 77% of respondents. This compared with 55% who gave these responses in 1972. Regarding Alex Campbell's imagery, Crow found his overall acceptance as a good leader had improved substantially since 1972, but was still short of its 1970 level. While he was given improved ratings for fulfills promises, Crow found that Campbell was still perceived to be more interested in planning than action. The survey provided an ironic note, reporting a tendency to view Campbell as being too young to be premier, more than 7 years after he was first elected. On the other hand, Conservative leader Mel McQuaid, who had just turned 62, was considered to be much too old. The standards had obviously shifted dramatically from Walter Shaw's days as premier. The overall message from the September 1973 study was that Islanders were satisfied, a remarkable finding considering the amount of change being implemented and the turbulence and angst of the summer of 1971. Overall, Crow reported that the most significant problem for the electorate in September 1973 was immediate economics. Specifically, he found that Islanders were more concerned about inflation and the higher cost of living, and about wages and working conditions, than they were about either job security or the development of farming, manufacturing, or the fishery. After immediate economic concerns, Crow reported that Islanders wanted a government that really cares about and understands the people, a government that gets things done, provides strong and active leadership, and is honest and competent. Next in order of importance was preserving the island way of life. For a premier in his 8th year in power, it was encouraging that Prince Edward Islanders were not more stirred up, especially given the extent of substantive and structural change. The Crow survey indicated that Alex Campbell was providing Islanders with leadership that both challenged and satisfied them. Campbell was evidently rocking the cradle in more ways than one.